But the last couple of times I shared with you, we've been talking very much about external events and the activist history of Unitarian Universalism in the context of the nexus of spirituality and politics and promoting our values out in the world. And that's very much, as I say, a part of Unitarian Universalist history and one of the strengths of our free faith. We also, though, talk about growing our souls, that the inner and the outer connect, that external events affect us, but as we grow in our own sense of self and dignity and capabilities, we then reach out into the world in more powerful ways. So this is more of an inside-out talk today, and but always in the context of being of service to the world. And I want to start by just noting that an expanding body of scientific research shows that our psychology and our physiology, that is our mind and our bodies, are intimately linked. Study after study is showing this, and lately an additional layer of connection is being explicated, namely how our cultural beliefs also affect our biology. And here are two brief accounts that attest to this. I have adapted the first one a little bit and slightly abridged the second. If a person raised in what we might call the modern world is diagnosed with anemia, a physician can treat it successfully. But if the same symptoms of anemia, fatigue, shortness of breath, dizziness, are diagnosed in an Indian or mestizo patient by an Arvayan shaman in the Bolivian Andes as Limpu, L-I-M-P-U, no amount of intervention by Western medicine can save the patient. The cause of Limpu is culturally attributed to witnessing a stillbirth, and the belief is that the spirit of the infant consumes the body of the person who witnessed it so that the spirit can remain on earth. Interestingly, white Bolivians living in that exact same area of the Andes do not succumb to Limpu because their Western cultural ancestry does not contextualize anemia as this affliction. Okay, a silent poll before the second reading. Don't raise a hand, but be honest with yourself. Who here is thinking something along the lines of, oh, those poor superstitious primitives. Okay, report number two. Unbeknownst to most women, Breast Cancer Awareness Month, October, was initiated 30 years ago by, any guesses? A guy, good guess. A mammogram company. A mammogram company. Thus was born one of the most successful campaigns for breast cancer screening ever, all based on the notion that early detection saves lives. This is a powerful cultural belief that has been shown to have fundamental flaws. The results of a landmark study by Abe Lyer and H. Gilbert Welch, both physicians, was published in 2012 in a New England Journal of Medicine article entitled Effects of Three Decades of Screening Mammography on Breast Cancer Incidence. The researchers estimate that in the last 30 years, breast cancer was overdiagnosed in 1.3 million women, as screening detected tumors that would have gone away on their own or never become clinically significant. In 2008 alone, 70,000 women were overdiagnosed with so-called breast cancers that were actually ductal carcinoma in situ, DCIS, which is not cancer and which does not progress. Yes, some women are helped by mammogram screenings, about 8 cases per 100,000. Compare that to the 114 per 100,000 who were overdiagnosed. Before this new data was available, the U.S. Preventive Services Task Force recommended that women younger than 50 decrease the frequency of mammography, noting that the potential harms of overdiagnosis, such as undergoing chemotherapy, surgery, and radiation treatments, outweighed the benefits. Despite the fact that this recommendation was based on an unbiased review of decades of accumulated data, a huge public outcry ensued. There is a profound cultural belief that breasts are two premalignant lesions sitting on women's chests, and that our only hope of survival is regular screening. Because of this, the recommendation was criticized as an assault on women's health, and a poll published in USA Today found that despite these new guidelines, 84% of women who were 35 to 49 years old planned to ignore them. Dr. Lisa Rosenbaum wrote about her experience working in a women's cardiology clinic, a heart clinic, where every new patient was asked, "What is the number one killer of women?" These are Dr. Rosenbaum's words. Mrs. S., a middle-aged woman with high blood pressure and high cholesterol, answered in a way that sticks with me. "I know that the right answer is heart disease," she said, eyeing me as if facing an irresistible temptation, "but I'm still going to say breast cancer." Ms. S.'s response short-circuited my statistical litany that heart disease has taken more women's lives than all types of cancer combined and is largely preventable. Her sense of risk was clearly less about fact than about feeling. Would more facts really address those feelings? And then back to the reading. The answer to Dr. Rosenbaum's question is, of course, a resounding no. When it comes to our health, our cultural beliefs are far more potent than any other factor. Very different cultural experiences, yes? But does the second not also contain a fair amount of superstition, or at least a denial of the statistical facts? Sure, we humans is funny things. Both of these passages came from a book by Dr. Mario Martinez entitled The Mind-Body Code, How to Change the Beliefs That Limit Your Health, Longevity, and Success. Now, I'll wager that most of us here very much want greater health, longevity, and success, yes? I'll wager further that many of us, myself included, have read other self-help how-to books and perhaps attended workshops or retreats and the like that touted these related benefits and maybe even promised that your life would be transformed. Am I correct? And I'll venture one more thing. It didn't work. Meaning that while you might have gained some insights or valuable tools and ideas, and we might have felt a wave of positive commitment that felt unstoppable at the time, after a while, we found that despite our initial enthusiasm and our best efforts, the behavioral patterns we'd hoped to transform were still with us. What's up with this? And can I please get my $300 back for that last workshop? What's up, says Dr. Mario Martinez, is this. Early authority figures, parents, teachers, coaches, and others, play central roles in molding our concepts of ourselves and our world. That's nothing new. They generally mean well, but in trying to direct and protect us, they unwittingly use the language that Dr. Martinez identifies as the language of shame, abandonment, and betrayal. And these also wound us. Dr. Martinez calls abandonment, shame, and betrayal archetypal wounds, because they are nearly universal across cultures and because they of the ways that their painful symptoms show up are so similar. Let's take the wound of abandonment, for example. A four-year-old has had a grand time playing in the park and now doesn't want to leave. The parent has been trying to persuade the child, but now the child is crying and won't budge. And the parent reaches their wit's end. As a parent, I know this can happen. "Okay, I'm leaving then," they say, and they walk to the car and get in. Anybody ever witness this? The child cries harder and doesn't move. The parent starts the car and starts to pull out, and the kid now screams, frozen in place. The parent knows that they're not really abandoning the child, but the kid doesn't know that. And the terror of abandonment is layered on top of the original frustration. And further, because this is done in the context of love, it's really confusing for the child. So later in life, she or he unconsciously melds love and abandonment and might well choose relationships where that mix gets played out over and over in very painful ways sometimes. Just to quickly offer kind of an alternative aside, set a clear boundary and stick to it. We're going to leave the park in 5 minutes. Then by all means, do it. And when the child protests, if they won't move, remind them that they said we were going to leave. Gently pick them up, protecting yourself from flailing arms if need be. Take them to the car and leave. Amidst the screaming, say something like, I see you really don't want to leave, and I always care about your feelings. And mom or dad makes the decisions for our family. Then turn on some nice music and enjoy the ride home. And it's okay to turn it up really, really loud. Now, these woundings do not affect all people. Some folks do manage to exit childhood relatively unscathed and intact. But sadly, as we find, not that many. And in his clinical work as a neuropsychologist, Dr. Martinez saw that so many people suffer detrimental effects both psychologically and biologically from our woundings that he dedicated himself to seeking antidotes. And over the years, he made a profound discovery that each of the three archetypal wounds has what he calls a corresponding healing field. Commitment heals abandonment, honor heals shame, and loyalty heals betrayal. In our example, commitment heals abandonment. By setting a clear boundary and sticking to it, you're committed to your word. You're committed to your child's well-being despite their protests. You're committed to the reasons you chose to leave. And you may be committed to others with whom you have prior commitments. For example, perhaps you told your partner, we'll be home for dinner at 6. Now, I know as a parent that this is much easier to say when not in the heat of the moment. And of course, it's fine to sometimes be flexible too. But parents and authority figures so often fail to be clear and calm, and thus unwittingly create wounds. And connecting this back to our bigger subject, Mario Martinez states that we always have the option to blame those who wounded us for our current distress, and therefore, what? Any guesses? Stay in distress. Blame does no good. Who here wants to blame and have more of the same? Anybody? Not me, personally. Good, because Martinez says there's a better option. Quote, we can instead untangle the communication pattern that links love with shame, abandonment, or betrayal. We can do this by engaging the healing field that corresponds to the wound. Engaging honor for the pain of shame, commitment for the pain of abandonment, and loyalty for the pain of betrayal. Well, that's encouraging, right? But how? According to Martinez, to achieve sustainable healing and change, we have to confront, release, and replace what we tend to modify. More specifically, we need to confront our fears, release a dysfunction that has become an ingrained pattern, and replace the mostly unconscious sense of unworthiness we feel with worthiness. Because, says Martinez, what underlies our dysfunction is our avoidance of feeling worthy. Wait. Not feeling unworthy, but our avoidance of feeling worthy. What? Why on earth would we want to avoid feeling worthy? Martinez explains, because just as supportive love teaches us that we are valuable and worthy of a good life, archetypal wounds teach us to devalue who we are and believe that we are unworthy of a good life. We unconsciously invest in confirming what our authority figures taught us to believe rather than what we have the potential to become. In other words, the damage that wounds can inflict on your sense of self-worth can paradoxically lead you to sabotage your own attempts to correct your failures as well as your attempts to succeed. So if avoiding our worthiness blocks us from improving the quality of our life, what can overcome this unconscious investment in that unworthiness? For sure, what doesn't work are approaches based on fear, anger, and guilt. As Martina says, fear induces avoidance. When we're afraid of something, we naturally want to stay away from it, including another person's disapproval. Anger invites aggression. If we yell at someone in defense, what usually just inflames things, and it rarely helps. And guilt promotes punishment, often self-punishment, but we also might punish the other person, seeking to get back at them for laying a guilt trip on us, because deep guilt is painful. Instead, Martinez lays out a 7-step program, 7 principles, 7 steps, easy to remember, a seven-step process of embodied inner liberation. And as I see it, it's actually simpler than that. I say embodied because mental approaches themselves don't cut it. For example, he says, the word shame is a symbol that represents the hurtful statements that cause the emotion of shame. You're stupid, you're worthless, you're bad. When the word shame is embodied, the symbol is transformed into what he calls a bio-symbol that can trigger embarrassment, blushing, drooping shoulders, and other manifestations. The word acquires biological properties. It gets into our cells. And I'll add that if we have an archetypal wound and it goes untended, it will color interpretations of other statements so that you hear innocent statements as shaming. For example, let's say a supervisor at work reviews a project you're working on and says, this part could be better. This may be completely accurate because you have the talent to do better, and it might be said supportively. But if we're entangled in that wound of shame, we hear it as, you're stupid, you're worthless. And the same bodily reactions occur. Your head hangs, your energy deflates, and then it becomes harder and harder to go to work. And logic alone, trying to talk yourself out of it, doesn't counteract our reactions. Because, again, these things are in our bodies. So as Martinez says, we learn embodied dysfunctions, and we hopelessly attempt to change them with disembodied reasoning. I wish we had the time to engage in it all right now, because it's a powerful process, but I will describe the steps here, and we'll do one brief part as a meditation. And we'll do more of it in the prayer circle today, so afterwards, if you're interested in joining us, please do that. And I'm new to this myself, so I'm not promoting it as a panacea, but I'm truly excited about the prospects of this method for my own life, and I just wanted to share it with you. So here are Dr. Mario Martinez's seven steps that engage what he calls the mind-body code, the programming lodged in both our minds and our bodies that we need to access, confront, release, and replace. The first step is to simply identify your archetypal wounds and the authority figures who created them. This is not about getting stuck in blame. It's just getting clear on how it happened and who inflicted it on you. Two, embody your memories of the archetypal wounds. In other words, notice where they show up in your body. If you think of that experience, what happens to you physically? Three, untangle your archetypal wounds from your intimate language of love. In other words, from our earlier example of the parent's message to the stubborn child, I love you, but I'm leaving you. It's a mixed message, and it's very confusing, and we still hold those confusions sometimes in our minds. Number four, access your history of what he calls elevated cognitions and exalted emotions. These are two important agents of sustainable change. Another term for elevated cognitions, he says, is higher thinking. And he gives some examples. Admiration, recognition of moral conduct, dignity, modesty. In other words, they reflect what he calls graceful acknowledgement of human excellence in yourself and others. And the exalted emotions include love, empathy, compassion, gratitude, awe, inspiration. Many of the things that we encounter here, hopefully, most Sunday mornings. In the exercise itself, you think on these times that these were present in your experience, and you notice your mind-body's response. And importantly, when we do that, we focus not on the times that we received such thoughts or feelings, but on the times we demonstrated them to others. So in other words, we're imagining ourselves, and we are really, not as passive recipients, but as active agents in the world. Number five, he says, mourn your, quote, known misery before replacing the vacuum its absence will leave behind. He talks about known misery versus unknown joy. We have a choice. But we don't remove something dysfunctional before we've decided what we're going to replace it with. It's like even if a pillar on a house is weak, we don't knock it out before the new one's in place. Six, embody the healing fields. For shame, that would be recalling honorable moments. For abandonment, recalling commitment. For betrayal, it would be recalling loyalty. Again, not the times you received these, but the times you gave them to others. And we're going to do a short exercise on this sixth step before I move into number seven and their conclusion. And so I would just ask you to find a comfortable position. Put down anything in your lap, perhaps, and just take a couple of deep breaths. All of these steps begin with the same way, which is getting into a contemplative mode. And I'll just say one word about that. Contemplative practice is when we shift our awareness from interpreting what our mind is doing to simply witnessing what it's doing. We don't put judgment on it. This is good, this is bad, this is right, this is wrong, I should be thinking this, I shouldn't be thinking this. It's just noticing. Dr. Martinez says, by relaxing your body and reducing the internal noise of your mind, contemplation opens a direct portal to your archetypal wounds. So I'm going to just talk us through a bit of a relaxation, and then we'll go into this sixth step for just a couple minutes. Sit in a quiet place and gently close your eyes. Rather than trying to relax, control your thoughts, or engage in any other intentional action, simply observe your mind-body activity. Observe any thoughts, emotions, and sensations that enter and exit your awareness. Allow your mind-body awareness to flow without directing or labeling the flow. So let's just take a minute and breathe. Notice anything going on in your mind and body. Just notice it and let it pass. Become present to the moment, to any thoughts, emotions, or sensations. Let them come and let them go. Just relax any tension in your belly or shoulders, but not striving to do so. Just breathing. While we might do this a little longer in a different setting, we're going to move into the six-step exercise. Just continue to breathe and stay present to the moment. And now shift to recalling early memories and experiences that you can relate that corresponds with an archetypal wound. If you felt abandonment, think of some instance in your memory. Or betrayal. Or shame. Where you felt less than you knew yourself to be. So again, in another setting, we might go through several memories, but just try to find one. And now, bring up a memory of its corresponding healing field. If you have a memory of shame, think of honor, a time where you honored another person in some way, shape, or form. You recognized them, you affirmed them, you helped them. If you feel the wound of abandonment, think of a time where you offered commitment to somebody or something. Where you said or did, this is what I'm going to do, and you did it. And if you feel a wound of betrayal, think of a time where you were loyal to someone else, even when it was difficult. This could be something a month ago, or it could be when you were a child in the schoolyard. And we won't do it long now, but what we would do in an exercise is spend several minutes going back and forth between these two poles, thinking of the wound, thinking of its counterpart, thinking of the wound, thinking of its counterpart. And you might do this through several instances in your mind. And it's this oscillation that Dr. Martinez says, where the healing field, quote, gains strength, or the archetypal, while the archetypal wound field dissipates. The healing field gains strength while the wound dissipates. Take one more minute with that oscillation. What he calls the shifting process. And then just take a moment to return to your center. Return to the present moment. So the seventh step that Dr. Martinez lays out is to then evaluate your relationships with your present, relationships of both misery and excellence. In other words, are there people in your life that bring out the best in you? And are there people in your life that tend to drag you down? And then you have to decide, what is the nature of my relationships going to be with each of those people? The obvious recommendation being, hang out with the folks that bring you up and minimize as much as possible your contact with the folks that bring you down. And it's important on the heels of this exercise to say one more thing, that Dr. Martinez stresses that since resolving archetypal wounds doesn't involve reasoning, you don't have to analyze or understand what we just did intellectually. That said, he also makes clear that it's not a quick fix. Rather, it's like learning a new language. Repetition and practice are required. But he concludes, the payoff is enormous. Because, he says, the healing fields are vastly more powerful, honor will inevitably overwhelm shame, commitment will resolve abandonment, and loyalty will transcend betrayal. So instead of carrying these things around with us, dragging down our energy or having us react in certain ways to situations when we're not fully conscious of why we're doing so, we're free. Energy flows. Choice becomes clearer. A lot of good things happen. And finally, he states one more critical concept that I need to share with you because he puts it so well and so simply. A wound is a state of helplessness, and healing is a return to empowerment. A wound is a state of helplessness, and healing is a return to empowerment. And the world so sorely needs people today who are psychologically and biologically whole and empowered. Because all we have to do is pick up a newspaper and you can just see how many people are playing out their wounds in the public square day after day after day. So healing ourselves is not a self-centered pursuit, but a means to living a life of vigor and connection and creativity and effectiveness in the service of inclusive, empowered love. Like the cultural stories about health I began with, our culture also tries to tell us what the parameters of our potential are, or should be, and how we should apply it. Sure, be powerful in the service of the status quo, which today means the corporate state. But dream big and activate your fullness toward a world of justice and peace and real community and freedom and sustainability? Not so fast. Not so fast. But on the concept of velocity, Martinez says this: I propose that we achieve what we wish for at a speed determined by our cultural beliefs and by the strength of the actions we take that confirm our intrinsic worthiness. By the strength of the actions we take that affirm or confirm our intrinsic worthiness. So, take these steps, or whatever steps work best for you. It's serious business. claim your intrinsic worthiness. Heal your life. Realize your promise at last. The world needs every bit of what you have to give.